warm welcome to all our Campus FM listeners today. This series is entitled Back in Time, and in all the episodes we shall be discussing broad themes associated with the study of archaeology and trying to understand why these various fields are really important in the exploration of the past. Before I introduce today's guests, I'd like to mention that this program is being recorded on location, so if you hear a few noises off, you'll know the reason why. Well, helping us in our explorations today is Anthony Bonanno, Professor of Archaeology within the Department of Classics and Archaeology at the University of Malta. In truth, Professor Bonanno needs little introduction. So I will just say that Professor Bonanno has been lecturing since the early 1970s, is the author of numerous books, and an acknowledged expert on Roman statuary. Welcome, and thank you, Professor Bonanno, for accepting to come on the program to talk to us about the importance of marble statuary and sculpture within the field of archaeology. So, on with my first query. What do you think it is about marble that has drawn people to use it as a resource for sculpture? And are there different types of marbles? And can you tell us something about its makeup and where the marble is usually found?
Right. So marble is just another stone, really. And stone has been in use for expressing art, sculpture, since prehistoric times. In the very beginning of early modern man, or, you know, famous Venuses of Willendorf and so on. But there are particular qualities of marble which makes it even more preferable. It is a carbonate mineral, like stone, but this stone has been metamorphosed. It is really a metamorphosed sedimentary rocks, and metamorphosed under certain pressures, very, very high pressures. I'm not going into the origin of the etymological question of the origin of marble. It's probably from a Greek word, which reflects its brilliance, which is its most evident quality. Another quality is that it is much more resistant to weathering, whereas when quarried, it is much softer, much more pliable. Then we imagine it could be, because at the end we will get that impression of very, very hard stone. So, apart from that, of course, it is very, very pleasant to look at. Although we have to keep in mind a feature that not everyone realizes, that is, even in antiquity, marble statuary was actually painted over, like our statuary in our churches.
But that's always an interesting point that I think many people, as you say, don't know about.
Yes, we got to know it from science by analyzing the residues of traces, very faint traces of color, and there's a whole science behind it now.
The painters of the statuary were as famous as the people who carved them.
Yeah.
An observation, many people, if asked about this subject, would probably associate marble statuary with the well-known examples from ancient Greece, and would probably concentrate on aesthetics, as we were just talking about, rather than their archaeological significance, which is what we're focusing on today. Would I be correct in saying that the earliest marble statuary goes back to the archaic period in Greece, 6th century BCE? And do the different styles that developed, in fact, tell us about the people who carved the objects?
Yes, in answer to your first question, that is, how far back they date, you're correct. I would probably add another 50 years to go about 650 BC. And the period spanning from 650 to precisely 480, you have a precise date, is referred to as the Archaic Age. And whether this art tells us much about or anything about the contemporary people if you expect to find a reflection of the likenesses of these people, you would be disappointed. First of all, one has to place Greek art in context. Statuary in hearts, different heart stones and stones and even harder stones like porphyry, black marble or black stone goes back to about 3,000 years BC or BCE in Egypt. As a matter of fact, the sculpture of the Archaic Age, especially the three-dimensional figures, freestanding figures of nude young men, seems to be inspired by similar statuary of pharaohs in particular in Egypt. However, as you see the difference between 3,000 and 600, 650 at most, it's a late arrival from a Greek point of view. And I was saying that this statuary of the Archaic Age does not give us a lifelike image of the people, even when there is an attempt to represent individual persons. These figures are stylized, their facial features are abstracted with bulging eyes. So if one is looking for true likenesses, it's not the case. We would have to wait for the 480 and afterwards to see a great difference, a great shift, a rather sudden shift, which ends this type of stylized rendering of the human figure to a much more realistic or naturalistic, is a better word. But on the other hand, this second period is characterized by idealization. Not only gods are depicted as perfect, but even humans are depicted so perfect as to be raised to the levels, to the platforms of the divinities, they become gods. And this makes people reflect on whether there is a reflection of this in Plato's denigration of art as being twice removed from reality. In Plato's concept, there are each object, including humans, people, are copies of an idea that exists somewhere in the universe. And therefore, an imitation of examples of that idea are twice removed from this idea. Of course, here we have two very different periods. The Archaic Age is just stylized. Perhaps the sculptors were in search of this idea. We don't know. But then, of course, on the opposite end of the spectrum, there is this idealization of the human figure.
It always struck me that the archaic figure, the Kuroi, are so different to the period that came later, the statue of later. It is a real change. I mean, it's amazing how that change happens. But I suppose if one looks at contemporary art examples, there are moments when art sort of just changes completely and people accept it.
Yeah. But we refer to it very often as the spirit of the age, Zeitgeist, as the German word used. You notice this. I mean, you can't escape it. I mean, there is an age, and you find that the art produced in that time is a reflection of that age. You know, like even Impressionism in the modern world, classical age, and so on.
The statues that we are familiar with, without the painting, obviously, without the decoration, say a lot of, not only about the past, when they were actually produced. Perhaps the mindset and the zeitgeist of the epoch, but also about our own Western civilization that, of course, is so heavily influenced by ancient Greece. And it's ironic that we are very impressed by these white statues and this beautiful, luminous marble, when in actual fact, the people who were enjoying them at the time were not seeing them like that. I always find that rather amusing.
Yes, in fact, the first reflection is that they are too garish for the aesthetics that we have set of principles, the aesthetic taste that we have formed over thousands of years.
The statues themselves, just before moving on, as a reflection of the age, though, it was the time of the Greek city-states. It was a particular time in history.
Yes, absolutely.
So that, do you feel that the statuary does reflect sort of what was going on in other areas of Greek life?
In this case, there's nothing really that sort of must have forced Greek sculptors to depict human figures, especially, and even animal figures, but human figures in particular, in that style. Rather than, well, I mentioned Egyptian influence, but there is also Mesopotamian, Assyrian in particular. This is contemporary with Assyria and the Near East, where even the anatomy of the body is emphasized with, you know, very stylized knees and muscles and so on, as opposed to Egypt. So that's what I can think of. But there is nothing really in the political life, the social life of the archaic age, which tells me, look, this is the reason why the Greeks chose to depict the human figure in this style.
But they did like their heroes, didn't they? So I suppose heroes are always supposed to be the best. So perhaps there's something there.
Yes. I mean, it's a question of aesthetics, really. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So, really, so we've been talking about this, but sort of how, why are statues and reliefs also, because we have to say there are many splendid reliefs rather than statues, so important in the understanding of archaeology, or rather the past. Are they useful? Why are they useful? Or are they sometimes misleading?
In terms of archaeology, archaeological functional role, sculpture plays a really minor role to other objects that are smaller, like fragments of pottery, because from fragments of pottery you can, first of all, perhaps even reach the original whole vase. And within the Greek context, most of the prized pottery items were actually painted over with scenes that reflected the mythology, and therefore you could read the story behind them. And even after 150 years, of almost two centuries of history of Greek art, you can even arrive to conclude artistic personalities through their styles, through their idiosyncratic way of expressing the lines and so on. Whereas a statue is rather bulky, and even if you find it in context, it's unlikely to give you any hint, an indication of the thin layer to which it should have belonged. Because its size would encompass various layers of satigraphy. So I wouldn't give that much importance, archaeological importance, in the sense of satigraphic dating. However, sculpture is of course much more eloquent in terms of referring to story, mythological stories, and if they are depicting specific human figures, therefore portraits, and even more so when we consider relief sculpture, because when a relief expresses at least an episode in a particular, let's say, collection of reliefs referring to particular mythological stories, or even preparing or symbolizing particular historical episodes. And this is where, in fact, I wouldn't mind anticipating a little bit, we see the great difference between Greek relief sculpture and Roman relief sculpture. Because whereas the Greeks commemorated very important events, like their triumph, like their victories over the Persians on two occasions of 190 and 480, a Persian invasion, by a huge empire, which was warded off by a group of city-states, you know, which were at loggerheads with each other all the time. And the Greeks decided to celebrate these victories. The best example, because the magnificent is the Parthenon, which is full of architectural decoration and relief, which do not, however, depict any of the contemporary episodes of the war, the Persian war, the war against Persia, but it is reflected, these victories are reflected in the stories, in the mythological stories that are expressed in this, like the so-called pedimental sculptures and the triangles, the empty triangles on each shorter side of the temple of the Parthenon, as well as the metopes, and with reference to, particularly with the Parthenon, there is also a long frieze depicting a procession that took place every 4 years. However, the metopes in particular show different episodes from mythology which reflect the victory, the final triumph and victory of civilization, Western civilization, really, over the Eastern barbarism. Although the Persians were, you wouldn't call them barbarians nowadays, they had very developed civilization, but they, of course, the Greeks looked down on anybody who was foreign to them. And so, whereas you have this type of commemoration, historical commemoration, the Romans are the opposite. They had a great embedded sense of history, and they wanted to show in their historical readings, in their commemorative readings, the actual episode that took place in battles, wars between Romans and other barbarians, Dacians, you name it, even against the Greeks themselves, you know.
In fact, that's a very nice segue into my next question, which is to say, obviously, that you're a particular expert in Roman sculpture. I would like to ask you about the sort of basic differences between Greek and Roman statuary. You've already mentioned this sort of different attitude to what they want to really want to represent. What are the differences that tell us a bit about the past?
Well, first of all, one has to admit that the Romans made an even much later arrival in art. The Romans were not artists. Art was not part of their character. They were soldiers and farmers, mainly. But at one stage, they came face to face, let's say 2nd century BC, came face to face with this rich civilization, which they conquered. But as a local Roman or Latin writer tells us, Horatius, Horace, capta graeca, perum victorem, quaepit, that is, Greece having been captured physically by the Romans, in turn, Greece captured the Roman, the ferum Roman, the savage, practically, uncouth, victor. And it reflects the truth. I mean, Romans were taken over by this rich civilization, and they brought about a phenomenon, the copying phenomenon of masterpieces. First, they started by plundering whenever they invaded and dominated a city, starting with Tarentum first, and then Syracuse in Italy and Sicily, but then even in the Greek mainland. They plundered all the treasures, works of art, that they could lay hands on. And this brought about the importation of masterpieces, like, you know, the masterpieces of the 5th century. Not so much Phidias, because Phidias is famous for sculptural architectural reason, which remained in place. But another artist is Polykleitos of the second part of the 5th century, who was famous even in antiquity for his athletic figures. But these, all these origins were transported to Rome and placed in public places, and some of them ended up in private houses. And this brought about a fashion of embellishing one's own dwelling, one's own house and villa, with origin powder. But however, there was a limited number of origins, and so the Romans started commissioning copies of these, which brought about an explosion, if you like, of such figures, such copy. As a matter of fact, we know even these masters like Polycletos and those of the 4th century BC, Praxiteles, Scopas, and so on, only through copies. Whatever we find, the first thing that you realize is that this is a Rome, an ancient, but Rome copy of the one. One has to remember, to keep in mind that in terms of freestanding statuary as opposed to reliefs, architectural sculpture, the Greeks preferred bronze. But bronze is semi-precious metal. It could easily end up in the melting pot. And that explains why most of the masterpieces of the classical period vanished. We don't have them anymore. And we know all these masterpieces through Roman copies in marble. There is an exception in the 4th century BC, Praxiteles, who actually preferred to work on marble. And there is one particular statue which might possibly qualify as his own, that is original, because it was found in the place where it was intended to be, that is the sanctuary of Olympia in southern Greece.
Is that Dionysus?
It is, yes, the Dionysus and Plutus, yes.
Yes. Yeah. We saw that together.
Exactly.
I had the privilege of visiting that.
It's very windy. But there are certain features that produce some doubt as to whether this is really the case.
So, as an expert, would you, take a freestanding statue, I mean, would you be able to sort of look at it and say, you know, this is a Roman freestanding statue, as opposed to a Greek one, from the way it's done, apart from who the figure is?
There are ways, technical ways of identifying copies. Very often, slight protuberances, almost imperceptible protuberances are identified in, say, places like the leg or the breast and so on, which suggest the copying technique, the pointing technique, which was used in antiquity. You know, a wooden framework would be placed on the origin, and points are taken and fixed so that the sculptor knows where to cut off, remove whole chunks, and where to be more careful, to slow down, and that way they could produce almost perfect copies of the origin.
In the very little time we have left, unfortunately. I would like to just talk very briefly about, if you could tell us a little bit about the local examples of statuary that we have here, which I know that you know very well indeed.
Yes. Unfortunately, we do not have that much. I would have preferred, this is anathema, for more to have been taken over by the Greeks rather for this.
Yes, I think we all feel that a bit.
Yeah, so I miss the Greek aesthetics and Greek works of art. However, we do have our share, both of mythological representations of divinities and so on, as well as even that's where we excel, but even more so in portraiture. For which I forgot to say the Romans excelled, or perhaps, you know, made their origin contribution. Well, for example, I've just published in the catalogue of sculpture that I'm publishing, compiling in the website of Herdijmont, a slab of marble which represents an episode from Homer. That is the ambush of a character called Dolon, who offered to do some espionage on the Trojan, on the Trojan camp. And he ended up being ambushed by the, by two Greek heroes, including the Odysseus, one of them is Odysseus. It is an inferior quality piece of sculpture, but still, I mean, it shows, it was found in Rabat, it shows that there was a, at least a hint of Greek civilization. The other one is a whole collection of sculptures representing members of individual members of the imperial family of Claudius, the Emperor Claudius, that is 41-54 AD. And there is, there are hints that that particular age, the age of Claudius, something must have happened. We still don't know, which prompted this prolific importation of these portraits, of imperial portraits.
That's fantastic. I hope we'll do another series which will home in a little bit on Malta. So I run out of time. I'd like to thank Professor Anthony Bonanno for being with us, and I hope that our listeners will join me again next week when we shall be tackling another important theme in the field of archaeology. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.